I want to introduce my guest today, Brett Godfrey. I'm recording this after I've had an opportunity to meet with him and talk with him both on and off the show, so I have a good feel for what he's like and the kind of book that he's written. So he's written a very intense techno thriller. It's about bioviruses and terrorist organizations, but the book is really good. Even if you check out some of the people who didn't enjoy it as much, we'll all tell you it was a great read, even though there were other parts they didn't like. Even when I picked up the book, I started reading it at night, and, you know, I was only a few pages in. I was like, I can't read this to fall asleep. It's going to keep me up. So the book is really good. Not only that, but this is Brett's first published novel, and when he was surfing around to find a narrator for it, he approached the top guy in the industry, who is very particular about the projects that he picks up. And Brett was able to at least convince him to check out the first couple chapters. And when he heard back, the guy said he loved the book, he had read the whole thing, and he would be happy to take on the project. And this is a guy who does, you know, Clive Cussler and Vince Flynn, who does these really big authors. And he picked up this debut novelist whose book may hit it big, but hasn't yet, just on the strength of the story alone. Not only that, but Brett's got a great biography. He was a gunsmith. He took place in competitive skydiving, and those elements of his life come out in the story. So there's a detailed realism there that you're going to find in few pieces of work similar to his, just because of his own life experience. So this is the interview with Brett Godfrey, debut novelist, and his book is terrific, and that is Black Sunrise. He's going to tell you about it right now. All right, Brett, go ahead and tell us about the book you wrote.
Well, I wrote a book called Black Sunrise, which starts off with the abduction of two adult females, young adult females, from the Cherry Creek Mall in Denver, Colorado. And you as the reader are very quickly made aware of the fact that when the abduction takes place, the abduction itself is being recorded and observed by the FBI and by a North Korean terror cell of espionage specialists. And the FBI doesn't want to interfere with the abduction because they are aware of the fact that the North Korean observers are going to blackmail one of the kidnappers, who happens to be probably the foremost biological weapons researcher in the world. And he's developed a very, very deadly virus that is capable of a controlled plague based on very sophisticated genetic modifications to the virus. And as a result of that whole setup, the police do not want the girls found. They've been ordered from the highest levels to stand down their investigation after missing persons reports were filed for the two. One of the two abductees has a father who's a very famous trial lawyer on the West Coast, and he's connected. He's got a lot of resources, and when he finds out, and a former prosecutor at that, he can tell when the police are stonewalling an investigation. But it's his daughter, and he can't possibly bear the thought of losing her. So he hires a former CIA agent who's started his own security company to find and hopefully rescue his daughter and her best friend. And so that sort of kicks off the plot for you, and it goes a lot of different places. It's had almost, I think, 4.6 out of 5 stars on Amazon, 4.4 out of 5 on Goodreads. So terrific feedback. It has an excellent Kirkus review, and I've gotten a lot of positive feedback from readers who write to me.
Yeah.
I'm real excited about it.
Yeah. I think one of the things I really noticed when I read your reviews is even the negative reviews said that it was a good, quick read, and they just had other problems with the plot. But I mean, everyone, even those people who didn't rate it really high, still said they really just enjoyed the overall flow of the story, which I thought was really impressive, right? When even your least positive reviews are still saying, yeah, it was a good read, though.
So. Well, the negative reviews tend to come from one specific criticism of the book, and that is it's too scary.
Too scary.
And I was having lunch the other day with a young lady who had read the book, and she said she had to put it down halfway through because it was making her have bad dreams at night. and she said she gave up on it, but then a few days later she started to realize that she couldn't let it go. She had to find out what happened. So she picked it back up and started reading it again.
Yeah, yeah. When I picked it up, so some books I like to read during the day, you know, and some books I like to read at night when I, you know, just as I fall asleep. And I started Black Sunrise, and I didn't get too far into it. I was like, I can't read this at night. This is going to keep me up.
So. Well, at least you don't get bored reading it.
Yeah, you definitely don't get bored reading it. For me, it was not something I could relax and read.
Yeah.
All right. Awesome. So if you were to compare it to a really well-known author or a really popular work of fiction, what would you compare it to?
I think it would be a blend of maybe Stephen Hunter and a touch of Daniel Silva. My writing style, I've tried to keep it unique so that it doesn't look like I'm cloning somebody. You know, there's a whole lot of good writers out there today that clone Tom Clancy as best they can. And that gets a little tedious because everybody's doing it. And I was very conscious of my voice and my style as I wrote the book to try to keep it a bit unique to me and my method of wordsmithing.
Yeah. So on Amazon, what categories did you put it in as far as your genre goes?
Thrillers, techno thrillers, and suspense thrillers.
So techno thrillers. Is there some futurism going on in there outside of...
There is. It's nearer to hand than you might think. When you read the book, it sounds a little bit out there. But I did an unbelievable amount of research writing this book in terms of genetic engineering, viral biomechanics, computers, computing, data analysis. There's a lot of that type of technology in the book. And that's where the techno thriller angle comes in. But it's really more about people. The technology creates a backdrop of interest and something new and different, but it's the people that matter in the story.
So awesome. Okay, so this was one thing that kind of surprised me. So when I first got the email reaching out to me for an interview, most of it was about your biography and your history and all the different things that you've done. And initially, I thought you were a nonfiction author. And then when I checked out Black Sunrise, I was like, oh, no, this is a work of fiction. So, I mean, you've built, a career in other fields. So why did you choose to write this fictional novel?
Well, that's a really interesting question, but the short answer would be I've been aspiring to write since I was about 15. I formed a friendship with a famous writer who I, at that time, was my favorite writer in the world. He's passed now, but his name was Mark Olden. He lived in New York, and I loved his books. And so I started writing to him, and he answered every letter I wrote. And the next thing you know, we were pen pals. And that went on for decades, literally. I wanted to be like him, but I love stories. I love reading fiction. I read over 100 fiction novels a year. But I also absolutely adore the craft of creating the same. And in the meantime, I had an exciting life. I was an Air Force officer, pilot, and a competitive skydiver, lifelong martial artist, trained combat shooter, a painter, and a gunsmith. And so I've had a lot of other interests, and I've got a deep medical background, which is a byproduct of my career in the law. I do litigation, civil litigation, and a lot of that involves claims against healthcare professionals and medical device manufacturers, drug makers, and so forth. So I've been sort of forced to get a really deep base in human physiology. Yeah.
Having heard all the pieces of the book and then your background, like you can see how they just it just flows right into each other there.
Yeah. For example, there's when we first meet the main hero of the story, he's in the process of a sport skydive down at a place called Skydive Arizona in Eloy, Arizona. And he has a malfunction while he's skydiving with the world championship team, Arizona Airspeed. And he's just a guest on the team that day, but he has a terrible parachute malfunction. And the day before I wrote that chapter, I had the exact same malfunction.
Whoa, that's intense.
Yeah, I was jumping with skydivers that were almost as good as the ones in the story. And I had a horrific parachute malfunction, and I had to solve it. And the next morning I got up and I thought, I need to write this chapter right now. I wasn't ready for that chapter yet. But I thought, if I don't write this now while this experience is fresh in my mind, I'll lose some realism.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just you telling me that makes me want to read that chapter. I'm like, I got to read that chapter. That sounds crazy. So I have a question. With so much of the book coming out of experiences like that, are there author notes? Is there anywhere like at the back of the book where you said, hey, these were real. These are the things that really happened to me that created these scenes. Is there anywhere in there that where that happens?
Well, there is an author's note at the end of the book, but I don't describe the writing process. There's a lot of geopolitical context to Black Sunrise, and that's based on years of research that I did into the politics and various aspects of living in North Korea. Mm-hmm. And because the North Korean spies are trying to get this horrible virus out of the United States, and they actually get their hands on it. But the point is that while I'm focusing on what's going on in all those places, I started to form some more substantive political and geopolitical thoughts, and I express those at the end of the book.
We talked about how you were 15, you met this writer, and you know that was kind of where you thought maybe you would write a book. So, what happened, I guess, in your life that you started to write the book now?
Well, I started my first novel when I was 19 years old on a manual typewriter while I was still in engineering school. And I worked on that book for about 2 years until it was finished. And I've gone back and read it since. And I think I set a world record for the most horrible story ever written. and the worst writing. It's probably the absolute worst novel in the history of man. But I still have it. And some of the characters in that early story are lead characters in Black Sunrise.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. Yeah, I think, I don't know about all writers, but I know myself and many of the writers I've met have had the experience where you write your first novel. And usually this is an unpublished novel, and for a good reason. And as you're writing it, you think it's just brilliant. And then by the time you've written your fifth novel and you go back and look at it, be like, oh, my word, this is a train wreck.
Yeah. Well, I wrote after I got to know Mark Olden just by reaching out to him. He was such a gentleman and such a kind human being. But then I reached out to Clive Cussler, who lives in those days was a Denver man. And I live in Denver. So I reached out to him, and he wrote me a letter that I have sealed in glass on the den, in the wall of my den at home. And it says, my first baby never did get published. And then a year and a half after I got the letter, he came out with a book. I think it was called Pacific Vortex. And it was the baby that never got published. And he actually puts an apology at the beginning of the book. He says, this is my very first novel. I thought, what the heck? Why not publish it now that I'm a known guy? And you can tell, I mean, the book that planted him on the map was Raise the Titanic. And so Pacific Vortex is not on the same plane as the rest of his work. But it was really fun to read nonetheless.
Huh, interesting. All right, we're going to take just a brief break here. And then we get back, we'll probably start diving more into just dialogue with some examples and your experiences. All right, we are back. So let's talk about dialogue specifically, as that's kind of our big focus here at Start Writing for the moment. So what are, I guess if you were to talk to yourself before you sat down and you wrote that first novel, what advice would you give yourself and even more specifically about writing dialogue?
Well, that sort of opens up an earlier question, which is whether to do extensive detailed outlining before you actually start to write the prose of your book. And I've met many famous authors who say that you should outline. People like C.J. Box says, for example, he outlines in detail, and he says it's because he doesn't have time not to. He says that keeps him organized and moving faster. On the other hand, I've gotten to be good friends with Wilbur Smith, who's a very famous fiction writer from South Africa. The president of Pam Macmillan Publishing Company told me that Wilbur was the best-selling living writer, because his backlists go to the 60s and they're still hot. They're still selling. And I asked Wilbur, what do you do when it comes to prep? And he says, I sit down and I read the book as it appears on the screen in front of me. He said he doesn't plan anything. It just unfolds. Book writes itself for Wilbur Smith. And there's a lot of guys in between, such as myself, who will do a lot of note-taking and a lot of ideas and a lot of dialogue with myself to start to really understand the person. So here's my advice to aspiring writers. If you know your characters intimately, and I mean, they are you, you are them, but they're each an individual personality with a distinct, unique way of dealing with life, including a unique and distinct way of speaking. When you have those real characters alive in your mind, you just sit them in a room and let them talk to each other. And the dialogue will write itself, and it'll be good dialogue. But if you have characters you haven't thought through beneath the surface, you'll have very superficial writing. Your dialogue will be flat, and it won't be realistic or interesting. It'll come off contrived.
Yeah, I think that's a great comment. Just this morning, I was actually working on an episode where we're talking about subtext and dialogue. And one of the things that makes for great subtext is that not only does it make the emotion feel more real, but a lot of the character has to come through to make that subtext possible, right? Because without that character layer there. So I think, yeah, that the well-developed character is going to produce that great dialogue because they can create a lot of good subtext.
Definitely, definitely. But, character development occurs through dialogue. And the dialogue has to be based on the real deep character. So you've got to do that work up front. But once you've got that done, you realize that telling a story is not the same thing as showing the reader what's happening live. So the reader gets to know the character because the way that character speaks is different than the way a different character speaks. And they have their own habits and nuances and quirks and mannerisms that makes them unique. And that's what makes them interesting, especially if they're unusual people. Yeah. And the people in Black Sunrise, some of them are very unusual.
Awesome. Okay. So I guess that's your advice to your younger self. Sit down, really develop these characters beforehand. Let them, talk to each other in dialogue to develop it. What is some of the best advice you've gotten about dialogue? Maybe you read it in a book or just a recommendation from a friend. Something that they have recommended to you?
Well, the lesson that I just tried to share, I first learned from Mark Olden. And then to a later, much later point in my life, I learned it again. By listening to speeches by Stephen Hunter, who comes to Denver a lot, and even to some extent from Wilbur Smith, because he's a natural genius at this. But the best overall advice I can give anyone when it comes to dialogue, young writers or beginning writers, try to think about what they want to happen in the book. And that turns into what we call a plot-driven novel. Plot-driven novels are pretty good. A good example of a plot-driven novel would be anything written by Clancy. But character-driven novels always have more depth. They're always more interesting. And so you don't ask yourself, what do I want to have happen here? You ask yourself, what would this guy do at this point? Because I know him. What would he do?
Yeah.
And you let him do what he would do. You let him be him. You let him be. And the same with every other character. And once you pour the ingredients in, the plot kind of comes out by itself. Now, that's not to say there's not a lot of chronological planning, but the thing that makes a good novel good, above all else, is good dialogue.
Okay, so let's say you've gone through the process, you've got your first draft down. Is there anything you do in your editing to then improve the dialogue once it's already out there?
Yeah, and that opens up another thing, too, that it's like everything comes in pairs with me, it seems like. But when one of the people that I spoke to right after the book started becoming successful asked me, I have writer's block. How do I solve writer's block? And I said, there's no such thing as writer's block. It's a made-up word that really applies to something else that isn't writer's block. I mean, you could say it is, but it's the need. You know, if people think writer's block is, I can't think of what to write. That just doesn't happen. Anyone can think of something to write on any given day. What causes writer's block is a built-in, spring-loaded internal sensor, C-E-N-S-O-R. As soon as you think up a sentence, you ask yourself, would that be a good sentence? And the little voice in your head says, no, no, no. Every time you come up with something, no, no. You have to shut that voice completely off. Do not censor your work while you're writing. You have to be absolutely willing to pour it all out. And when you do that, you'll get some really great stuff and some really awful stuff. Editing is a different thing. You do not edit while you're creating. You just create. You be creative. That's what you do as a writer. Editing is a different thing. You take off your writer hat and you put on this ruthless, tough guy in your mind. And you say, all right, let's cut this thing to shreds. Let's really pull out a razor blade and go after this thing. And that takes several iterations. So you write a book once and you edit it 15 times. And if you do that and you're ruthless with your editing and you try to put aside pride of authorship and in favor of good writing, good sentence structure, good style, good grammar, good flow, and then things will sort of come together for a great final product.
Yeah, for me, my view on writer's block is that if you've got writer's block, you're approaching the writing process wrong, right? You're trying to either outline too much and you're not an outliner, or you're just trying to, just sit down and write like Wilbur does, and that's not the kind of writer you are. That's usually my view on that, is that when you find the writing style that really works for you, it's a very easy process. That blend of just sitting and writing and outlining, wherever you fall on the spectrum. Because I know some writers who, they said, I outlined my book to the hilt. He says, and then when I sat down to write, I was bored because I already knew what was going to happen.
Yeah, I can identify with that.
Oh, really? So for me, I was like, really? Like having it out, like I don't outline it to the hilt. I need some wiggle room in a chapter. I find that, but. You know, some people, they just, you know, I think, what is it, Brandon Sanderson? Last I heard, he had like a 200-page outline for his novel. I was like, that you almost wrote the novel there, man.
That wouldn't work for me. It works for some people.
Yeah. But yeah, just finding your place on that spectrum is what really eliminates the writer's block. Because I think my third novel, I tried to just sit down and write. And every day was awful. I would sit down at the blank screen and be like, oh my gosh, what am I going to write? So, yeah.
Yep. I think if you're not entertained by the process of reading your words as they appear on screen, neither will the reader be.
Maybe. I think for me, it was just like to try and just, fill in, you know, all the details and be thinking of all the big plot things all at once was just overwhelming for my brain. It didn't like doing that.
Yeah, I agree.
So, but everybody's different, you know, like some people, they just sit down and they write and that's how they have to do it. Whereas other people just outline like crazy. So.
Well, my second book, Convergence of Demons, which is about to come out now, I decided to try the CJ Box method and do some detailed outlining. So I outlined the first third of the book in great detail. And by the time I was halfway through the second chapter, my inner writer took off like a dog off a leash.
And it shifted, yeah.
And it's like, I don't want to mess with that outline. The story is writing itself and it's doing very well. And the next thing you know, the outline was completely obsolete and useless.
Yeah. You have to find where you're on that spectrum and then the process gets really easy. Okay.
And that's not to say you don't spend a long time developing the story in your head.
Yeah.
Before you write, you develop the story, the context of what's going on and so on. But it's different to sit down and rigorously put bullet point, bullet point, bullet point, bullet point, and then you have to stick to that slavishly. I just don't think that's effective.
Well, you know, everybody approaches the process different. Like I said, I know some who just, you know, everything is like, they like, I know one writer who every paragraph has at least one sentence in the outline before he sits down to write. And he's just, you know, filling in the rest of his paragraphs. And that's, he loves it. You know, whereas for me, it's like, I need a little bit of freedom to move. And my outline can't be so detailed that if I vary from it, I feel overwhelmed at the work of recreating it.
Yep. So, I agree.
So, but okay. So let's get some examples of dialogue. Why don't you pull some examples from your work and then talk to us about kind of what went into them and what makes them, you know, really work.
All right. Well, let me set the stage a little bit by telling you that the weapons researcher is the leader of the two kidnappers. And he has psychologically programmed a younger man by tapping into his aberrations, his lusts, his frustrations, his sense of low self-esteem. And he's literally turning this man into a weapon. His whole theory is, this one slogan is, life is death is life. And so after they kidnap the two girls and they have them secured in a remote cabin up in the mountains outside Steamboat Springs, they're sitting down grilling steaks in the patio. And the older man, Arthur Beeman, is explaining to the younger man who's being rewritten, and he's being drugged at the same time, into a weapon, into a monster. But he's explaining to the young man what the virus is that he created. So here we are, and this is a portion of a longer discussion between Beeman, Arthur Beeman, and Antonio Pessoa about what the virus is and how it was developed and the near psychic component of creation that went into the rewriting of the DNA to make this very special virus. So he tells Antonio that he's had, you know, this inspiration, this aha moment. And so Antonio says, some kind of drug-induced divine inspiration? Beeman says, you could say that, Antonio. What I knew then was beyond words, beyond expression, even mathematically. I saw the structure of life itself in the patterns and vibrations of subatomic particles. Beeman was whispering now. Antonio noted that the music had ended. I saw what life is made of. Beeman continued, would you like to know? This discovery affects you. Sure. Life is a question, and death is the answer. Death recycles itself. Life is made from death. It emerges between cycles of death. But without death, there can be no life. But hey, without life, there can be no death. Well, there you have it. Life is death is life. So the meaning of life is death? More aptly put, Beeman says, the essential source of life is death. This is more than just understanding the cycle of life and death. I'm referring to the underlying generator of the life cycle. Life itself has certain frequencies, but I've discovered that death does as well.
Oh, thank you. So talk to us about what went into this dialogue section here.
Well, I had to set the scene in my own mind. What mood was Beeman in at that point? Because he's not normally so loquacious. What mood was Antonio in? And given Antonio's level of education, his personality, his awareness level, how would he absorb this very cosmic level of revelation that allowed Beeman to create the Black Sunrise virus? So once I had all of that, and I already understood Beeman very well, and I already understood Antonio very well, I just let it run. I just said, start. And they started having a conversation, and I just caught the words, and I became a scrivener.
Nice. Then let me, I think in my communication with Julie, she mentioned an audiobook that you were going to send over a clip there. Will that clip have this conversation? I'm kind of curious.
Well, yeah, I'd have to figure out where that came from just now. that's page 49 of the hardback. And that's chapter in the audiobook. That's chapter 8.
Probably not then. Usually when they send me a clip, it's like 1 to 3 chapters is what I get.
Oh, yeah, I could send you the whole damn thing if you want. But
well, I just want to do is after the interview, what we'll do is we'll just say, hey, if you keep listening, you can hear the first couple chapter of Black Sunrise in audio and see if it interests you.
Yeah, there's a free sample on my website, brettgodfrey.com. That's BRETTGODFREY.
Do you know how big that sample is? Because I know if you go to Audible, the sample's like a minute.
No, this is longer. I think it's five chapters.
Okay, yeah. Then, if I don't get that in her, then I will definitely, I'll pick it up there and we'll put the full five chapters here in the interview.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out that my audiobook narrator is a man named George Widall. And he does all of Daniel Silva. He did Vince Flynn. He did a lot of the guys that are in my genre. And he's kind of the top guy in the world.
Nice.
So when I contacted him and I said, you know, would you be interested in doing the voiceover?
No. Can you hear me?
Okay. I said, would you do the voiceover for my book? And he says, well, I've never heard of you. Who are you? And I said, I'm nobody. I'm truly nobody. And he said, well, what's the book about? So I gave him the verbal description. He said, send me a couple of chapters. So I sent him the whole book as a PDF. And he called me a week later and he says, you have it. You've got the stuff. This is so exciting for me. I would love to do your book.
Nice.
And I said, how far did you get? He says, I read the whole book. And he says, once I started, I literally couldn't put it down. Now, coming from George Widall, that's a very big deal.
Yeah.
So I'm very proud of the audiobook because George did a terrific job.
Awesome. All right. So let's talk about where they can find you and your book. Talk about everywhere you can find them and then talk about your preference. Where would you most likely to direct your traffic?
You bet. Well, the book is available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Goodreads, Google Books, a lot of different places. The hardback is only available at Barnes & Noble. The paperbacks are available at all those other locations. The ebook is available on Amazon. I think the ebook is only available on Amazon, and the audiobook is available on iTunes, Audible.com, and a bunch of different outlets.
Okay, awesome. And then I guess what would be your preference? Where would you be like, hey, if you have your choice, where would you love for them to get the book? Where is it best for you, so to speak?
Well, it isn't. It's nothing's better for me in terms of, you know, I get roughly the same royalties from everybody, but I think for the reader, it's going to be more convenient just to go to Amazon.
Yeah. Okay. And then the audiobook, you mentioned that. Okay. And then you did mention your website. Can you state that again for us real quick?
Yes. My website is Brett Godfrey, BRETTGODFREY.com.
And there's the five chapters of the audiobook there, as you mentioned.
Yeah. And you'll also see samples of the sequel to Black Sunrise, which is called Convergence of Demons.
Awesome. Anything else?
Just thanks a lot for having me on your show.
Yeah. Thank you for your time.
Chapter 1. Today, we become merciless gods. These five words would change Antonio Pessoa's life forever. He chanted the mantra in his mind as he surveyed the crowded lower level of the Cherry Creek Mall, gazing down from the level above. Sunlight poured through glass ceiling panels onto shoppers as they flowed around him like a living river. His heart hammered over tranquil music wafting from a nearby shop. He lifted his hands from the railing, noting sweaty handprints left in the chrome. Would they be found later? Of course not. Thousands of people touch these railings every day. Detesting his fear, he smudged the prints with his forearm and dried his palms on his jeans. We will create a new reality. The power of Beeman's words calmed him. He pushed away his hesitation. It was time to break free, time to become a god. His eyes settled on a girl on the level below, his breath caught in his chest as she looked up and locked eyes with him. She was plain, heavy, and her stringy hair seemed pasted to her skull. He grinned awkwardly, repulsed by her splotchy complexion and the blank expression on her face. She looked away and kept walking. Another reject. But would she remember his face? Stop. Thinking fearful thoughts causes fear. Okay, then. But the more time he spent just standing around, the more likely he would lose his nerve. He needed to find the right person and get it over with. He'd been trolling the mall for hours. Beeman would be getting impatient, which made Antonio feel... He turned to the sound of rich feminine laughter behind him. Two young women in white shorts strolled by. He pivoted to watch them pass. Tan sculpted legs ending in wedge sandals thumped on the tile, an alluring rhythm to their walk. One blonde, one brunette, both pretty, early 20s. They had the hair, the clothes, the look. Expensive purses and shopping bags dangled from their arms. Pampered women leading pampered lives. When they were a dozen feet away, he fell into step behind them. As he matched their pace, he studied them more carefully, admiring them, stoking his imagination and igniting an inner fire that burned away his anxiety. A completely different kind of energy flowed through him now. It felt good. Either would be perfect, but both? Would it be possible? Antonio felt the primal ecstasy pulsing through him, just as Beeman had predicted, and was certain he would approve, he would admire the audacity. Taking both women would exercise Antonio's appetites, strengthening him proportionately. The shopping bags told him they'd been in the mall for some time. It was just past 4 p.m., and he figured they'd be leaving before too long. If they split up, he'd stick with the brunette. If they headed together to one car, he would, with Beeman's approval, take both women. At that moment, unseen and unknown, the future of every other pretty young woman happening to be in the mall that day was restored, and only Antonio knew it. He controlled so many destinies at once, simply by making this choice. Now he was thinking like a god. He faded back into the flow of shoppers to follow from a safe distance and texted Beeman to expect precise directions soon. Shopping done. Choice made. Expect directions soon. Beeman texted back. Ready? At West Ramp. Now they needed some luck. It would help if the girls had parked in the west lot, as Beeman was already there. It could take him too long to circle around to the east lot if the girls moved quickly. They'd need a few minutes away from prying eyes once the action commenced, and Beeman's SUV would have to be in place before Antonio made his move. Antonio texted again. Sights on pair of perfect ones. Probably same car. Get both? He waited for a reply. Then his phone buzzed in his hand again. Interesting. See how it plays out. Antonio smiled and kept pace with his new prey. They seemed to be heading to the second level exit, onto the west lot, which was perfect. Much later, Christy Jensen would agonize over the irony. She'd marveled at Jackie Dawson's skill at the art of drawing male attention, and for this, she would later curse her own naivete. But for now, it was just a fun summer Denver afternoon, shared by best friends, savoring their last 2 weeks together before Christy left for Dartmouth to start work on her master's degree in chemical engineering. "What do you mean when I grow up?" Jackie's laughter was infectious. "All I know is we're going to San Diego for the weekend. That's as far ahead as I can think." Shaking her shoulders, Jackie sent ripples to her chest while tossing her lustrous brown hair over her shoulder, her signature move. "Hotel Dell. I'll really make him forget about the dent." Christy smiled and shook her head, wondering what it would be like to live Jackie's life. No school, work, or career anxiety. Just rich men and eventual marriage. And maybe a baby or two. If only life could be so simple. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness through sex with sugar daddies. What are you smiling about, CJ? Nothing, Christy said. You should tell him before he sees it. I know, right? Like, get it behind me? But how do I tell him? Couldn't we, like, make something up? I mean, this sucks big time. Jackie sighed. How pissed will he be? Don't know, Jax, but he's under your spell, that's for sure. You think? Jackie smiled. Two-way street. And I don't care what my fosters say. Fuck them. Wait, you know, I don't mean that. I know. It's just the pressure of the whole thing wears me down. Jackie's biological parents had passed away when she was 10. Foster parents had raised her through her teens, living in a rundown apartment in Lakewood. Her current romance was with Robert Sand, an African-American man, which her foster parents did not seem to mind. What made it an outright travesty for them was that, at 56, Sand was more than twice Jackie's age. Christy knew Jackie loved her foster parents and burned at the thought of disappointing them, but her feelings for Robert were strong, at least for now, and Sand was hot. Christy remembered how Jackie had first described him, tight as a bowstring, gentle as a puppy, a face like Denzel, a bit of gray and a ton of green, hot as black embers and warm as the sun. Christy's upbringing had been much different than Jackie's. Her father was one of the most successful trial lawyers in the country. He owned several homes and two jets. She'd grown up wanting for nothing. That's the price you pay to do your own thing, Christy said. But the pressure comes from you, Jax. They worry, but they don't judge. Jackie had moved out of her foster parents' apartment when she was 19 to attend Denver University. Living on financial aid and student loans, she'd moved in with Christy, sharing an apartment for 2 years before dropping out to wait tables in an upscale steakhouse owned by a former NFL quarterback. There she'd met Robert, a regular customer who usually came in later in the evening when things were slower. Flirting turned into conversations, which led to meeting for coffee, dinner dates, and when things got serious, Jackie moved in with him. With Robert, Jackie finally had a taste of an affluent lifestyle, but she swore that his money wasn't what held the relationship together. Christy believed her. She was happy for them, but she wondered if the floor would drop out, leaving Jackie once again adrift. "Let's get out of here," Christy said. "Get it over with." "Be with me while I tell him?" Jackie asked. "Have dinner with us?" Christy moaned, "bribing me with food?" They pushed through the exit doors to the parking garage. Antonio followed them onto the dimly lit third level of the west parking lot, whispering into his phone, "Coming out. West lot, deck 3, same door I came in. I'm right behind them." There was no response. He worked some saliva into his mouth. "I'm ready. I can do this. We might be able to take them right here, snatch and go, like you said. Or we can follow them. Your call, but I don't see anybody around." Beeman did not respond. "Where are you?" Antonio asked. After a few more seconds of silence, Beeman's voice crawled into his ear. "Look to your left." 30 yards away, Beeman softly revved the engine of their rented SUV. Antonio nodded, slipped the phone into his pocket, and kept walking. Behind the wheel, Beeman shifted his attention to Antonio as he picked up his pace to close on the women, absorbing the whole scene as if through a microscope, studying how predatory life forms learn to consume prey. Beeman did not know that he was himself being observed, nor that his watchers were themselves under the scrutiny of others. 30 yards farther down, on the other side of the parking aisle, a sniper in the back of a dark van keyed his throat mic. He aimed the scope of his short-barrel Heckler & Koch PSG-1 semi-automatic sniper rifle through one-way optical film that concealed a firing aperture in the van's armored side panel. His call sign was Skunk 2. He was a GS-12 federal employee, formerly a hostage rescue team assaulter, now assigned to the elite special surveillance group of the JTTF, or Joint Terrorism Task Force. He was part of the so-called Skunk Team, an elite SSG unit tasked with tracking and direct action in the containment of terror cells and foreign espionage on domestic soil. Their legal charter was murky, as they were essentially paramilitary operators functioning contrary to at least the spirit of Posse Comitatus, a statutory limitation constraining federal military operations other than training on U.S. soil. Skunk 2 has glass on the Wallys. Wallys was FBI jargon based on Wali, Korean slang for a security officer. North Korean agents in this case, three of whom were seated in a small black BMW with darkened windows. They covertly watched Beeman, whom the FBI had assigned the code name Farmer, as he inched quietly forward in a rented Buick SUV, creeping closer to the two women he and Pessoa, codenamed Dirtworm, were tracking. Roger, Skunk 2. Against protocol, Skunk 2 shifted his scope. Farmer and Dirtworm are converging on civilians with hostile intent. Skunk 2, text intercepts, confirm imminent code silver. The commander spoke from a mobile command post out on the street, informing the SSG team to expect a kidnapping or hostage situation. Do not intervene. The code silver is not our mission. We have bigger fish. Skunk 2 gripped the stock of his rifle and laid his finger gently on the trigger. Christ, guys! Are we really going to let this play out? Skunk 2, you are 10-12, came Skunk 1's terse reply in his earpiece, meaning hold position, take no action pending further orders. Long game, eyes on the prize. The SSG team's mission brief stated the only subjects of interest were the North Koreans. Skunk 2 should not have moved his scope away from the BMW. Too much was at stake, and it had taken too much work and luck to get this close to the Wallys, who might make a move on Beeman under the watchful eyes of the JTTF and the National Security Agency, or NSA. Everyone on the SSG team was supposed to operate under specific rules of engagement, which specified that collateral damage was acceptable, particularly if it were the result of purely domestic crimes such as assault. The women were potential casualty statistics, nothing more. The high-value prizes were the Wallys and Beeman himself. If they could roll up the North Korean or DPRK spy ring, the intelligence harvest could help keep Kim Jong-un, known at Foggy Bottom as the Young-un, behind his fence a little while longer. Skunk 2 could only engage a target if the Wallys were to spot and assault the SSG surveillance team or make a grab for Beeman, who carried in his head information too valuable and dangerous for them to allow to fall into enemy hands. Roger. Skunk 2 lifted his finger from the trigger and sighed deeply as he refocused his scope on the BMW. This was the overarching tactical plan. National security took priority. He would simply observe unless ordered to engage. But Christ, it did suck. He had a daughter of his own. Chapter 2. As the girls approached a gleaming green Jaguar XKE Roadster, Antonio could just make out what they were saying. Slowing his pace, he watched them carefully. The brunette started to get in on the driver's side, but seemed to change her mind. She stepped around to the passenger side and set her shopping bag on the cement behind the car. The blonde did the same and bent down to run her hand across the fender. Antonio noticed a dent just above the right rear wheel well. The brunette groaned. What's another ding? The whole car has to be repainted, right? I don't know, the blonde responded, feeling the damage with her fingers. Ouch, Antonio said, startling the girls as he spoke from behind them. What happened? The girls stood and turned to face him. Oh, I was backing out of a parking spot, explained the brunette, and this old dude bumped us. Didn't see him coming. Actually, he was the one who didn't see me coming. I was backing out to get lined up better. Antonio shrugged and kept smiling. Happens all the time. He couldn't believe how this was landing in his lap. Now he had to play it cool, not try too hard, roll with it, and project confidence. He choked down his fear, and an idea came to him. Beeman was right. The magic will blossom. Shame. It's a nice car. Vintage? What year? The brunette turned to touch the dent. It's a 67. Think they can fix it? Antonio knew right then how it was going to work. They? Hell, I can fix it. Right here and now, if you want. Paint's fine, you just need a special tool. A dark green SUV pulled to a stop behind the Jaguar. At the wheel, a kindly-looking older man smiled and gave a casual wave. That's my dad. Tools are in the car. You got a few minutes? You can really fix that? The brunette asked. Sure, 20 minutes tops. You'll never know it was there. I'll show you how and explain it before I touch anything. He held out his hand. Jimmy Rivers, he said, nodding toward the SUV. I work in my dad's body shop. Should I give it a shot? Do it for free. What's the name of the shop? The blonde asked. Dad's Body Shop, Antonio laughed. That's my dad, Sam Rivers. The blonde looked uncertain, but the brunette shook his hand. I'm Jackie, and this is Christy, and yeah, that'd be great. How do you do it? Christy asked, shifting her purse from one arm to the other so that she too could shake hands. Don't you have to take stuff apart to get in behind the dent? Well, that's the easy part, Antonio said. Stepping to the SUV, he lifted the back hatch and unzipped a canvas bag. We go in through the trunk. The magic is in the equipment. Antonio lowered his voice slightly. This is a trade secret. If it got out, we'd be out of business. These tools are so easy to use. See? The girl stepped closer, better to hear and see the special tools. Antonio turned to face them with what appeared to be two garage door openers, one in each hand. No, no, Jackie! Christy started, seeming to recognize devices. Antonio fired the tasers at point-blank range, sending pairs of small darts into the belly of each girl, first one and then the other. Snap, snap. 5 seconds later, the girls lay prone at Antonio's feet, jerking and twitching as more than 60,000 volts coursed through their bodies. He quickly bundled handfuls of the thin wire that fed current to the darts, stuffing the expended units back into the canvas bag. Then he zipped the bag shut and tossed it into the rear compartment. The rear seats leaned forward to make extra room. Beeman sprang from the car and lifted Christy into the back of the Buick. As Antonio lifted Jackie in his arms, he was surprised by how light she was. He could feel the weight and shape of her, the shimmering, silky feel of her skin electrified him. He set her down in the back of the SUV. Before Antonio expected it, the girls were moaning, beginning to come around. Hush, Beeman hissed, pointing an aerosol can in their faces and spraying until they went still and for several more seconds for good measure. He pulled a blanket over them, holding his breath and stepping back to remain clear of the vapor. Antonio snatched up the shopping bags and purses, tossed them in with the girls and the duffel bag, and slammed the hatch. Let's move, he said, looking furtively about for witnesses. Seeing nothing, they climbed into the SUV and pulled away, Beeman gently spiraling around the many corners to reach the ground-level exit. Why so slow? Antonio asked breathlessly. Why draw attention? Beeman responded. Think we've seen? No, but we'll know soon enough. Once we make it to the storage shed and switch cars, we should be fine. They should stay out long enough to get them into my trunk. Then we hit the road, but remember to ditch their cell phones, or we'll lead the cops straight to us. God, you're right. I almost forgot about that. Antonio slapped the dashboard as they turned out of the drive and into the street. The sunlight seemed incredibly bright as they merged into the flow of traffic. 5 hours, and we'll be at the cabin, Beeman announced.